Dick Gordon, this is The Connection. People in London were back in the trains and back on the buses today. One morning after 50 people were killed and hundreds injured by a series of terrorist bombs, commuters in London are saying that they're determined to get on with work and get on with life.
You can't let this affect you. If you let it affect you, then, you know, those people have won. You just got to get back to some sense of normality.
I don't know. I think London is a bit resilient and the commuters will just carry on.
I worked for Cantor Fitzgerald at the time of the 9/11 disaster, and it all brought it back with what they went through.
Absolutely disgusted, really am. I just can't believe it. And I think it's about time we actually kicked back at these people and sorted them out properly, because you just can't go on like this. It's ridiculous.
Police in London aren't giving any information about the search for suspects, but it seems that the pattern and the style of the bombing is consistent with Al-Qaeda's earlier attacks. So where does that lead us? Will the attack in London change the debate, for example, over the war in Iraq? Will more people side with President Bush and Prime Minister Blair's claim that the war on terror continues and that Iraq remains one of the best places to fight it? Or will these attacks give new momentum on both sides of the Atlantic to people who are critical of the war in Iraq? Will they point to the bombs in London as proof that new terrorists are being recruited all the time? Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're starting today's program with Julian Borger. He is U.S. Bureau Chief for the British newspaper The Guardian, and he's joining us on the line from Washington, D.C. Julian, thanks for being with us.
Pleasure.
As you watch all this unfold from Washington, you know well the way that the U.S. reacted after 9/11, that sense of national solidarity. Is that what we're seeing in London today?
Yeah, very much so. I mean, I think there is this sort of London tradition of the Blitz and the IRA bombing campaign, in which the bombs stiffened the resolve and strengthened a sense of national unity, certainly of city unity in London. There's a feeling, I think, of we have to live up to that.
And short-term political implications for Prime Minister Blair. I mean, we see even his rival, leader of the Conservative Party, Michael Howard, saying that the country is united. So I would assume we're going to see over the next few days a lot of support for Blair.
Yeah, there's a rallying factor here, I think, very much. And, you know, he is, as a politician, as a statesman, he's good at these moments. His address yesterday certainly had, you know, Churchillian elements, and he is good at putting them across. His natural emotion came across, and I think these are times when he does well in the public eye after a long period of criticism and a certain amount of cynicism about his involvement in Iraq.
And the key, I think, Julian, is going to be what about the longer term? Because there have been so many people in Britain angrily opposed to the war in Iraq, and whether or not the bombings will be used as evidence that the war itself is a misguided venture. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think the consensus in Britain is, or rather the majority view in Britain, I should say, is that this was a mistake. The Iraq war was a mistake. We're not getting to grips with the war on terror. But the question is whether the impact of these bombings will strengthen the calls for Britain to get out. And I wonder about that. I think the stronger element will be a kind of rallying of determination to take on Al-Qaeda, Islamic extremism, and a recognition that now that we're in Iraq, we have to deal with what we find in Iraq. To pull out now would be giving the Islamic groups, if there were indeed Islamic groups, as is widely suspected, behind these bombings, it would be handing them a success. And what we saw in the IRA bombing campaign is that probably a disengagement from Ireland was delayed by the bombing campaign, because there's a feeling that we couldn't give in to terrorism because then we'll just get more of it. And so I think it will stiffen the resolve to stay on in Iraq until the job is done.
So what we saw in the days after the Madrid bombing, with people and the new government saying, right, that's it, we're out of this war, you're not expecting that kind of response in Britain?
No, I mean, I haven't seen it so far, and I don't. I mean, there will be calls for it, and there will be people pointing out that by getting involved in Iraq, we made ourselves a bigger target. But I think the dominant argument will be, this is our 9/11. We were targets anyway, just because of of you know, where we stand in the world. We are part of the Western camp, and we were targets anyway. And this may have been coming for us, you know, in the same way as it was coming to New York in 9/11. So my hunch at the moment, my gut feeling at the moment, is it will strengthen that sense of resolve and not lead to a big push to get Britain out of Iraq.
Julian, thanks for your time.
Pleasure.
Julian Borger is U.S. Bureau Chief for The Guardian newspaper. We're going now to Congressman Mark Sauder. He's a member of the Subcommittee on Economic Security, Infrastructure Protection, and Cybersecurity. That is part of the Homeland Security Committee in Congress. He is a Republican from Indiana, but he's joining us on the phone from Alaska. Congressman Sauder, thanks for being with us.
Morning, Dick.
Tell me if people in Alaska are talking much about yesterday's news.
It's a little more like a separate country, but yes, everywhere in the world is talking about what happened in London because of the extraordinary pictures, the terror associated with it. They don't particularly think they're a target here, but they understand the interrelationships in the world.
Do you think that the attacks in London are going to change the way that people have been debating the war on terror and the war in Iraq here in this country?
I'm not sure what the political reaction is going to be in the short term, but I think that there's an slowly increasing understanding that we're at several levels of the war on terrorism. In Afghanistan, it was to destroy their camps and their training systems of the large-scale organizations. In Iraq, we had a developing nation as a terrorist that were looking at longer-range chemical, biological, and nuclear weapons. The question is were we going to find them, which we haven't thus far, but we knew that they had the scientists, they had the training programs, they were building the facilities with which to launch large-scale chemical, biological, and nuclear attacks. What we're seeing here are more in London, to some degree in Madrid, are operations like Khobar Towers in Saudi Arabia, where they killed American troops, where you have smaller levels of not necessarily as coordinated as groups as 9/11, more like the Palestinian terrorists, like the IRA terrorists, which are a whole different challenge. But nevertheless, as we do Homeland Security in the United States, we have to watch for all types, nation states, those who harbor terrorists, and copycats, smaller groups. And that's why we're gradually building the infrastructure system in the United States at all different levels. And they haven't succeeded in the United States since 9/11 because we've been more vigilant. But this is going to get tougher, not easier.
Well, Congressman, just imagine for the sake of this conversation, yourself back in Congress. If you were listening to someone from the other side of the aisle make the case that these bombings are proof that al-Qaeda is recruiting new people because of the war in Iraq, how do you counter that argument?
Well, when there's a different worldview, and you confront people as they are preparing to attack you, obviously it's going to accelerate the pace and define which side of this battle you're on. I believe most, the overwhelming percentage of Arab Americans and certainly of Muslims around the world do not condone terrorism. But some of the people, when they watch this, say this is going to activate them. And that's an understandable risk. I chair the Narcotics Committee in Congress as well, and the Dawson family were firebombed because they fought the narcotics dealers in their community, and they were all killed, and their house was burned down. But that doesn't mean we shouldn't confront narcotics dealers because we're afraid. To some degree, your choice is either to roll over and surrender or to fight. And when you fight, they fight back, and they may even recruit more in the fight.
And so what you're saying is that even if the war in Iraq is, in fact, operating as something of a recruiting tool for al-Qaeda, better to deal with it now, better to face up to it now than see it in 5 or 10 years.
And there were just different assumptions. I understand in Congress we disagree, people across America disagree, but I do believe the facts are absolutely clear. What we in Iraq is that they had a plan. They used chemical and biological weapons on the Iranians. They had a plan to develop a terrorist nation, and the threat of chemical, biological, and nuclear weapons in a state, which is why we're watching Iran so close, why we're watching North Korea close, there we're talking millions. That Iraq is not precisely what these bombers were doing in London or in Madrid, but it does indeed have, I grant, some potential to recruit more of the low-level type operatives, but they were coming anyway. They don't like our position on Israel. They're anti-Semitic, and the radicals are. They don't like our position in economic development around the world. They don't. They believe it's a jihad that believes if they kill us, they go to a better place. It is a tough type of thing when you're dealing with extremists of any type of cult.
One more quick question, Congressman, and that is, do you find that the attacks in London act in some way as a reminder of just how vulnerable countries like this one remain to terrorism?
Well, potentially conflicts with nations like China, where you have huge power conflicts over turf and energy and economics, are still there. The world, as we become the dominant power, the world has shifted, and small groups, fringe groups from major religions of the world that become more like a cult, the nutballs who copycat that, are indeed the danger. And in bigger in places like Indiana, where I am, it's not a primary threat yet, but in bigger cities like Boston, where you have a developed subway system, yeah, we have to do better at protecting all different levels of that at our airports that are our primary targets. So it's a tough stretch ahead.
Congressman, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Congressman Mark Sauder from Indiana, joining us there on the line from Alaska. Our telephone number, 1-800-423-8255. When we come back after the break, we are going to be talking with the former Homeland Security Deputy Advisor, also Jonathan Stevenson, Senior Fellow for Counterterrorism. And we'd like to hear from you on how you see the bombings in London changing or affecting the debate over the war on terror and the war in Iraq. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection. This hour, we're talking about the effect and what it is that the bombings in London tell us about the current status of the war on terror and the war in Iraq. We'd like to hear your thoughts. We're at 1-800-423-8255. And we're welcoming to the program now Jonathan Stevenson. He's Senior Fellow for Counterterrorism at the International Institute for Strategic Studies, joining us on the line from Groton, Connecticut. Jonathan, thanks for being with us.
Good morning. Thank you.
And Richard Falkenrath, Senior Fellow at the Brookings Institution and former Deputy Homeland Security Advisor, joining us from the Brookings Studios in Washington, D.C. Richard, thanks for your time.
Good morning.
I wonder if I could get both of you to react to the general thrust of what we just heard from Congressman Sauder, because if I understand him correctly, he's saying the bombings in London, the war in Iraq, and you add it all together, and basically what we're facing is something that is going to be a life that is going to be worse in the short term, maybe more dangerous in the short term, but better off in the long run. Richard, would you agree with that?
Well, it isn't exactly what I heard him say. My sense is we had a terrorist threat prior to 9/11, we had a terrible attack on 9/11, and
right.
Then we, as a Western civilization, went on the offensive against this terrorism threat. It is dramatically reduced from what it was on 9/10, the day before 9/11. The threat we face today is a fraction of what it was when they had a sanctuary in Afghanistan, training camps, support infrastructure, cells deployed around the world. It still exists. It is very much still alive, but it is not what it once was.
Okay. So what you're saying, in fact, that there may not be terrorist attacks ahead before this whole war on terror.
I don't want to give the impression that somehow everything is far worse today than it was 3 years ago. In fact, I think it's substantially better today. Now, there still is a threat. There's no question. And there clearly is some dynamic effect of our offensive operations against global terrorism and their current recruitment. But over the long term, a relentless offensive against the terrorist groups themselves and their support infrastructure will serve to reduce this threat. In parallel, efforts to promote democracy in the Islamic world, where it hasn't ever really taken off, will also help, but in the long run.
All right, Jonathan, where are we today? What's your view?
I mean, I certainly agree that the intervention, particularly the intervention in Afghanistan, flattened al-Qaeda, completely compromised its command and control as any kind of central hierarchical organization, and made the threat of terrorism far less than it was on September 10th, 2001. There's a sort of separate intermediate question about whether offensive or going into Iraq and occupying, essentially occupying the country, has increased terrorist recruitment. I suspect that it has, but again, that does not mean that any kind of withdrawal would improve matters. In fact, it would make them worse by handing a victory to the jihadists. In fact, remains that the network is far flatter and more poorly organized than it was before September 11th. And even for example, if it transpires that there were some British Muslims who had gone to Iraq to join the jihad and came back to London to do their business there, even if that's true, withdrawing wouldn't be the answer. Rather, staying the course in Iraq and trying to realize some of the political goals, underlying political goals that the intervention had, would have to be pursued in order to come out with a net gain.
And Richard, if you were sitting around the planning table at Homeland Security now and part of that conversation, which no doubt is going on, what does London teach us? What do we need to look at now? What would be the one point you'd want to make?
Well, the best defense is prevention. It's basically impossible to perfectly protect a mass transit system. London does a very good job. But the best defense we have, without doubt, is to exclude terrorists from our country or to identify them if they are within our country, penetrate their cells, and take them down.
And Jonathan Stevenson, are we looking at a different threat today? Is that a part of what London is teaching us?
I don't think it's a different threat in essence from the one that materialized in Madrid over a year ago. I think, the fact remains that Al-Qaeda as a central organization has to depend much more now on upstart groups that coalesce often in the locale of the attacks themselves rather than from the outside. And therefore, you're looking at a kind of an infiltrating problem of in European cities and actually cities all over the West, and that the heavy lifting of counterterrorism redounds to local authorities, intelligence, and law enforcement in their coordination across the world.
That's my point, though. If there is no more head office in Afghanistan, does that raise the responsibility for local authorities? If they're, transit people working in New York or whoever they might be?
Yeah, I think it does. But that much was clear after 9/11 that as the network disperses,
right,
and infiltrates cities, it's going to be much more difficult to level a silencing blow or a decisive blow through some sort of military attack such as Afghanistan, that the responsibility for protecting people will come down much more to local authorities, to first response, to prevention, penetration, and law enforcement.
1-800-423-8255. That's the number for you to join us this hour as we try to take the measure of yesterday's bombings in London, place those in context of the war on terror and the war in Iraq, and see what's different today. To Chesapeake, Virginia, for our first call from Krista. Hi, Krista. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
The question you asked, what does London teach us?
Yeah.
My kids and I are going to London in August. They're 13 and 14. We used to live in Great Britain. We have lots of friends there and are so proud of the way that the British are dealing with this. My kids and I, several friends and neighbors have said, oh, you're not going to ride the underground. Well, we're going to definitely ride the underground because, as my 14-year-old said, if we don't, we're letting the terrorists win. And I think that's one of the, today watching the TV and people getting on that underground to go to work, that's how we're going to beat the terrorists.
So it's nothing not at the late. Breakfast table today, Krista, about, hey, what about going, say, somewhere else?
Absolutely not. And the other thing I want to I'd like to mention is the media, everything has just been focusing all the pictures, like the Indiana congressman said, of this terrorist attack in London. Every single day they're having similar attacks, similar body counts in Iraq. I mean, is an Iraqi life that's lost by through terrorism, is it less? And I really believe that we need to treat the terrorist attacks in Iraq much more, compassionately.
You don't make the kind of separation that I just made in talking about the war on terror and the war in Iraq then.
Well, I definitely do. I believe that, I believe that the war on terror, we took it to Iraq.
Yeah.
And so that now that we're there, we have a moral obligation to repair what we've done there and to help those people. Their lives, they're a human life just like we are here.
Richard Falkenrath, the kind of response that Krista's giving us, you know, not in any way to be cowed by that. Is that something that just comes from within individuals, or is that something that, you know, governments, Homeland Security departments can also try to encourage or take advantage of? Do you see what I mean?
Yeah, I do. And I think Krista has it exactly right on both her points, on not being cowed by the terrorism. I mean, she's got it exactly right, and she's doing the right thing. I think what governments do there is they try to set an example and they try to say the right things in public. But what it really comes down to is the valor and the hearts of everyday citizens going about their lives and not being deterred or cowed or scared off by the terrorists. Her second point, though, is also very important, and she's quite right. The terrorist activity in Iraq today targets in part coalition forces, but it also is targeting innocent Iraqi civilians who are just trying to get their life together. And she's right. The international media has paid an awful lot more attention to the atrocity in London yesterday compared to the almost daily atrocities committed against Iraqi civilians by groups that may or may not be ideologically aligned with the ones who carried out the attack in London.
1-800-423-8255 to Weston, Massachusetts for our next call. George is joining us. Hello, George.
Hi. I wanted to comment that the attack in London goes against the president's message. In the State of the Union address, he stated, "We'd rather fight them in Iraq than fight them here." If you remember that comment.
I do.
And I thought it was ludicrous at the time. Yesterday shows how ludicrous it is. That is, the terrorists, of course, would not choose to fight necessarily a well-armed force in Iraq. How about blowing up a tunnel in London? And these guys aren't stupid.
Are you saying that nothing has changed as a result of the war in Iraq? Is that the point that you're making, George?
That's correct.
Jonathan Stevenson, your thoughts?
Well, it's true. You know, it's true that you know, terrorists aren't going to be deterred by what we're doing in Iraq from hitting New York and London, but that it's also, I think that you need to make a distinction. President Bush was, I think, in a sort of a shorthand and oversimplified way, trying to say that the initiative in Iraq was, in its end result, going to outflank terrorists by creating a political situation in the Middle East, which made Muslims in general less inclined to tilt towards political violence. I don't think, you know, I don't think any counterterrorism analyst would say that that the effort in Iraq, in and of itself, is going to deter terrorists from coalescing in Western cities and trying to launch attacks. Which is why that it's a war that has to be fought on at least two fronts. One is to try to, sometimes in coercive ways, spread political ideologies and ideals that discourage terrorism throughout the world, and the other is simply in nuts and bolts homeland security, which tries to protect the populations of those Western cities. And then the connection between the two can sometimes be perverse, that the offensive efforts that the U.S. makes in Iraq can sometimes encourage Muslims in Britain, in France, in Spain, in the United States to take up arms in those cities against their citizens, and squaring that circle involves pursuing the democratization ideals and the state building ideals mm-hmm. that are going on in Iraq, and also firming up homeland security, and attempting to create the best relationship possible between a government in the West and its Muslim citizens.
Let me, if I can, go back to George and Weston. The point was made earlier in the program, George, that even if you happen to be one of the people who disagrees with the usefulness of the war in Iraq as a way of trying to reduce terrorism, that what's the alternative at this point? That to basically leave might, in fact, shift that fight that we're talking about closer to Western countries. Do you buy that?
No, I don't. I think that's a ludicrous argument. It just doesn't make any sense. Because right now the country is not quite, but certainly on the road to going broke. We're spending $150 billion a year in Iraq to, quote, bring democracy to Iraq, to prevent to kill the terrorists there instead of here. It's absurd.
I'm just the reason I ask you the question, George, is that I want to go way back in time, if I can, to the attacks that Al-Qaeda originally launched against embassies in Africa, against the U.S. Position in Somalia. Osama bin Laden, in his tapes and speeches, took advantages of those, saying, see, if you face down the Americans, if you shoot back, they will run away and we come out ahead. I mean, that's in part where that comes from. I'm not making it up here.
No, I think that's a fair comment. I'm reminded of the way in which there's certainly a case to be made, and maybe there's an analogy here, and maybe it's a stretch. The U.S. defeated the Soviet Union, if you will, by outspending them. In this case, the terrorists are defeating the U.S. and the Western nations, not by outspending them, but perhaps being a little smarter.
Richard Falkenrath, your thoughts on that?
Well, I've got to say I disagree pretty fundamentally. I don't think the terrorists are defeating the United States or the United Kingdom. In fact, I think the events yesterday show the strength of our countries. The markets are open today. People have gone back to work in London. As I said, the ability of these jihadist groups to carry out attacks of this kind is dramatically reduced from what it was prior to 9/11 when they had a sanctuary. The fire of jihadist militancy was lit well before the Iraq invasion. As you noted, it goes back to the 90s, even before the East Africa bombings in 1998. And if maybe the case is true that Iraq has thrown a little bit of fuel on that fire, but it was lit a long time ago, and our goal remains to snuff it out. And I think it burns far more dimly today than it did prior to 9/11.
Do you use the relative quiet in this country over the past 4 years as a measure of that, the fact that there have not been attacks on either symbolic targets or on softer human targets like a transit system?
I do. I think we need to be cautious about saying this sort of thing, but we know that Al-Qaeda and its affiliate groups have the intent to attack the United States. We are their highest target, without question, and they very much would like to hit us again, but they have been unable to. They've been unable to because we've taken down most of their command structure, we've degraded their infrastructure, we've identified some operatives and cells, we've tightened our border security, we've improved our domestic counterterrorism efforts, and a number of different things just make the United States today a rather difficult operating environment for them. Their affiliate groups have been far more active in the Middle East, in Asia, and particularly in Western Europe over the last 4 years. That's why I wasn't surprised that we had an attack in Madrid a year ago and London today.
And Jonathan, earlier in the program, Julian made a point about how London responded over time to the IRA bombings. I know you have some considerable expertise with that. Are there lessons in the way that that threat was reduced over time with what we're seeing today?
There are some fairly attenuated lessons, but because the IRA is a group of such a radically, drastically different nature than Al-Qaeda, I think you can't, you got to be careful about transferring lessons in any simple way.
The one that I wanted to ask you about, though, was public support, because the IRA could not have done what it did without the support of people in Northern Ireland and of people in this country. That diminished over time. Are we seeing any of that with Al-Qaeda? Is that an aim that's important?
Yeah, I mean, certainly it is, and particularly insofar as groups now seem to materialize either within or close to the countries that they target, i.e., British Muslims come together spontaneously rather than having been dispatched from Afghanistan. It is important to try to get the larger Muslim community of Britain or any other European country on board with the government's counterterrorism program, and that's certainly been an emphasis of the British authorities, and they do draw at least inspiration and broad lessons from their experience with the IRA, because a lot of the way in which the Catholic population was rendered more moderate in Northern Ireland was really through sort of enlightened social policies of the British government that were actually kinder to Catholics than were the policies of the devolved government that had preceded the Northern Irish Troubles.
I've got to stop you there, Jonathan. We're taking a short break. A reminder to our listeners, our number is 1-800-423-8255. the latest event in the war on terror, quite clearly the series of bombs in the London transit system. How does that change our understanding of where this battle lies? Does the war in Iraq factor into this in an important way? 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. Will people agree with President Bush and Prime Minister Blair's claim that the war on terror continues and that Iraq remains one of the best places to fight that war? Just reflecting on yesterday's attacks in London, will they give new momentum on both sides of the Atlantic to people, rather, who are critical of the war in Iraq? We'd like to hear from you. We're joined now by Timothy Garton-Ash, writer, historian, senior fellow at Stanford's Hoover Institution. He's on the line in Palo Alto, California. Timothy, nice to have you back with us.
Good morning.
We have talked in the past, Timothy, about this history of the Anglo-American connection that exists. And I'm wondering, as you mull over the effects of the bombing in London yesterday, is it likely to further strengthen this Bush-Blair coalition or weaken their case?
I think it strengthens the relationship between Britain and the United States. It was interesting to hear Rudy Giuliani saying that the example of London and the Blitz had inspired him after 9/11. I don't think it strengthens the case that we are winning the war on terror in Iraq. On the contrary, I think it will strengthen the criticism of the war in Iraq.
Do you mean that will further polarize both sides of this debate?
Well, look, I don't think this is not going to have the effect of the Madrid bombing. Immediately after the Madrid bombing, as you remember, the Spanish government changed and they pulled out. That's not going to be the effect here. But I think it will heighten the argument, because those on the American right who say, and as President Bush has said, either you fight the terrorists there or we'll have to fight them at home. Well, we're fighting them there and maybe creating more of them there, and they've struck in London.
Let me, if I can, Timothy, take the point about fighting them at home and change the verb slightly, because in large part what we've been talking about earlier on the program is how Al-Qaeda functions now without its traditional head office in the plains of Kandahar, that these groups need to function, and if they are going to succeed as terrorist groups, do their recruiting and do their dirty work in Britain or in the United States or wherever that is. Does this in any kind of substantial way change the approach of law enforcement people when it comes to cracking down on Muslims in Britain, in the U.S.?
I think it does. I mean, you and I have talked before about this misleading metaphor of the war on terror, as if terror is sort of Hitler's Wehrmacht, which can be defeated. It's not like that. And London is now the most diverse city in the world, and the Metropolitan Police have actually a very sophisticated approach, very deeply engaged with the Muslim communities in London. And if, to the extent this is a war at all, it won't be won by armies, it will be won by intelligent policing like that in London and intelligent policies.
Richard Falkenrath, former Deputy Homeland Security Advisor, is also with us. And Richard, just a thought from you on what Timothy's saying here, that change in the kind of policing, is it happening?
I think it's happening, and it started happening quite a while back. And this will reinforce the need to carry through with the reforms that both the United Kingdom, the United States, and other countries have enacted to improve their domestic counterterrorism efforts, which is a combination of law enforcement, public outreach, intelligence work, judicial procedures, statutes for governing when you can convict someone for a terrorism-related offense. And that will continue. But it's only one aspect of the war on terror. There are many other aspects as well, and they are not exclusive of one another. So it doesn't make sense to say that the war on terror is all about domestic counterterrorism mm-hmm. efforts. That is a very important part of it, but that's not it. We also have to eliminate sanctuaries where they exist, and we also have to try to address the root causes of terrorism to the extent that we can.
Would you disagree, Richard, with Timothy's point that the attacks are likely to increase criticism of the war in Iraq?
Yeah, I doubt they will. I think the critics have staked their position on Iraq. It's known. The supporters have staked their positions, and I doubt the events of yesterday are going to change anyone's mind. It may, as you suggest, polarize it a little bit more. the supporters of the war in Iraq will use the atrocity yesterday to strengthen their claims, and the critics will try to connect it to the events in Iraq. And maybe as we learn more about the attack, we will find out it is in some way connected. We don't know yet exactly who carried it out. But then again, maybe we'll find out it's completely unrelated, carried out by people with no ideological or logistical connection to Iraq.
Timothy, what do you think?
Well, I don't disagree with that, although I think it will increase criticism in parts of Europe of the continued presence in Iraq. But what I would say is that I think we in Europe, particularly in Britain, have been living with a threat of terrorist attacks for a very long time, for 30 years from the IRA. And I think this is what it's going to be like. I mean, we shouldn't fool ourselves that there's going to be a magical VT day when suddenly we win the war on terror. This is what it's going to be like. We're going to be living with a level of threat from terrorist groups of different kinds. And the challenge is to get that level of threat down to an acceptably low level.
Timothy, thank you for your time.
My pleasure.
Timothy Garton-Nash, writer, historian, senior fellow at Stanford's Hoover Institution, joining us there on the line from California. 1-800-423-8255. We're going to Burlington, Vermont. Salim is joining us from there. Salim, thanks for calling.
Yes, thank you. I think the key question which your guests are trying to address is whether our military strategy is working faster than recruitment by extremists. And I'm afraid that the evidence has really not been presented convincingly that the recruitment is actually not keeping pace with the military strategy. I can say from my own experience in Pakistan, some research I've done for the U.S. Institute of Peace, the recruitment is going up astronomically. And I think the public diplomacy aspect of this is certainly not working as well. And if we
Salim, let me ask you to be a little bit more specific here. When you talk about the recruitment going up, are you talking about people who are convinced that...
Well, my own research specifically focused on madrasas, Islamic religious schools, and in urban areas in Pakistan, it is going up astronomically. This is something which there are studies which keep bouncing off numbers back and forth, but the key is that the tone of the Muslim world in terms of extremist ideals, even among professionals, is going up, and that's very disturbing.
Okay, but my question is, are these people the kind of people who want to take part in bomb-making lessons and carry a weapon, or people who want to mutter about how much they dislike Donald Rumsfeld?
I think the latter is probably true for the time being, but it's very fast to have that transition, unfortunately, from, you know, people, as we saw with Mohammad Atta, who was, you know, basically an engineering student who then had, you know, just suddenly this manic urge to go in, to the wrong side. So, I mean, this is the fear that I have, is that, you know, decent, reasonable people will just get tilted over into lunacy.
Jonathan Stevenson, what is that line that Salim's talking about between people who get angry or annoyed or infuriated watching the news and then people who actually become radicalized to the point of doing something about that?
Well, I think that line does exist, and I think the people who just get annoyed in perhaps a transitory way, they don't cross the line, and they aren't moved to direct acts of political violence. But often the fact that there are fair numbers of those people in a given society or a given location means that the operating environment for terrorism becomes better, and some of those people may even contribute support services to terrorist activists, and at least will not be forthcoming to the security services, and therefore might make life easier for the terrorists. But I think the point that the caller made about recruitment increasing, particularly in Pakistan, is a good one. I think it's difficult to trace that directly to for example, the American-led enterprise in Iraq. Pakistan has been a focal point for radicalization for a long time, and I'm sure it has as much to do with, for example, Musharraf's post 9/11 closeness with the United States as it does with Iraq in particular.
And Richard, I know from my own work in that region that there is a sense in places like Pakistan where they just don't like the idea that men wearing American uniforms are tromping around the hills of places like Afghanistan or Iraq or anywhere like that. Does any measure of public diplomacy, that's what Salim was talking about, can any measure of public diplomacy turn that, or do you really have to address the act itself, the presence in those Muslim countries?
Well, I think Salim points an extremely important point, which is there is a really serious problem with recruitment in the Muslim world. Madrasas are part of that. They're religious schools that are often breeding grounds for extremists of one kind or another. To explain that, though, solely in reference to U.S. military involvement in Iraq or Afghanistan or the Pakistan border region, I think is not supported by any rigorous evidence or analysis I've seen.
It was part of it, though, right?
We don't know how big a part of it. It was going on prior to 9/11. Yeah. I mean, it was going on prior to the invasion of Afghanistan, prior to the invasion of Iraq. It was a serious problem back then during the Clinton administration when our troops weren't trooping around in Pakistan or anywhere else. And I think what I noticed a lot is people who don't like American foreign policy under President Bush often say, well, your foreign policy is what's causing this problem. Well, that's inconsistent with the history. The history is this problem goes back a very long time. You can date it many times to the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan or even the Iranian Revolution or the formation of the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt in 1926. This is a long, serious problem in the Muslim world. There are many different fissures in that world, and the divide between the Muslim world and the United States is only one of them. So let's not overplay this issue. And let's be careful about our own biases. Are we bringing our own biases about President Bush's foreign policy into this debate when it's really not analytically supported yet?
What do you think, Jonathan?
I mean, that echoes, you know, in many ways what I said, that it's the idea that Iraq is the root of all upsurges in recruitment is a vast oversimplification. Other factors include the closeness of various relatively secular Muslim leaders to the United States, the ongoing nature of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict is cited by Muslims around the world as a reason not to like the United States, and that's been going on for a long time, although things are looking better these days. The other point I would make is that it's true that the U.S.-led enterprise in Iraq has hit some bumps in the road. I mean, it hasn't met these, I think, rather rosy expectations of the first Bush administration that there'd be a rapid demonstration effect and that Muslims in Iraq and elsewhere would embrace the U.S. with open arms. But that does not mean that the underlying long-term strategic reasons for undertaking regime change in Iraq and now state building in Iraq are ill-advised. It's another, as I think Richard has said, it's not an either-or proposition that you devote resources to homeland security or to trying to effect political transformation in the Muslim world. One should do both. And the political transformation perhaps has hit some bumps in the road. We're not anywhere near the finish line, but now that we're there, there's little choice but to carry forward as best we can.
Let me stop you there and just swing over to Bedford, Massachusetts. Joel's been listening in and is joining us on the line from there. Hi, Joel.
Hi.
Tell me what you're thinking as you look at the scale of the attack in London and try and factor that into our collective understanding of where this country is in its war with terror.
Yeah, to me, the scale of the attack and the target says the Brits are doing a reasonably good job. It's not for me to decide how much is enough for them. But if the standard is nobody ever loses a life in any terrorist attack because every single one of them is thwarted, that's just a recipe for a police state. To me, that says if we had a large, well-organized, well-trained group, they were caught somewhere earlier. What got through instead was some much smaller and much less well-organized group. After all, if they're going to attack the subway, there are much more effective weapons than high explosives.
So,
Japan had that problem in the Tokyo subway system.
So, Joel, the balance that Jonathan was talking about, whatever it is, the war on Iraq, the war in Iraq, the war on terror as one element of it, and then a concentration on issues of homeland security. That's the balance that, as a taxpayer, as a citizen, you think needs to be pursued. Am I right?
Well, it is. That is the balance. And from my perspective, if that's the worst that they can do in London, probably we're in good shape. We here and they there in the UK. To me, actually, it says that worrying about homeland security is probably a diversion from what we ought to be doing in foreign policy, and that has to do with strategically undermining the universities in Madras, for instance. That has nothing to do with war. That has a great deal to do with security, though, in the long term.
I wonder if I can, though, go back to the point about homeland security. Richard, you're watching your former colleagues. They raised the level of alert for public transit as a result of yesterday's attacks. There's been, as you know, a lot of criticism over recent years about too much concentration on airlines and airports and not enough on public transit and chemical plants. I know you've written about some of this. Where do you think we are with that balance now? Are we getting it right here? Are we getting closer to it?
Well, no. Ever since we passed the Aviation and Transportation Security Act in right after 9/11, we've been imbalanced towards aviation security. As a result of the legislation, the federal government took over airport security, pays for it directly out of the federal budget, and we've spent over $20 billion on it since 9/11. A tiny fraction of that has gone to protect other equally dangerous target sets. And, you know, that's a function of how things get done here in Washington. It's not to say we can't. We need to do aviation security. That's clear. I would like to see a little more balance. I think, Joel, though, the British are doing this very, very well. And this is why this attack is interesting.
And instructive for the U.S. as well?
And instructive. I mean, they did miss one here. I mean, this was a serious plot, and it was a very bad terrorist attack. It was an atrocity. But they've managed to prevent at least three other attack scenarios, plots, in the past 3 years. And they've really had a lot of operational success against very active terrorist conspiracies inside their country. So they're doing pretty well, and we do have a great deal to learn from them.
Richard, I want to thank you for being with us on the program today.
Thank you, Dick.
Richard Falkenrath, Senior Fellow at the Brookings Institution. Jonathan Stevenson, thank you for your time as well.
Most welcome.
Jonathan is Senior Fellow for Counterterrorism at the International Institute for Strategic Studies. Earlier in the program, we talked with Julian Borger, U.S. Bureau Chief for The Guardian, Congressman Mark Sauder, Republican from Indiana, and Timothy Garton Ash, Senior Fellow at Stanford's Hoover Institution. Our program is produced by Sarah Baker, Jennifer Ehrlich, Catherine Fenollosa, Matt Lieber, Jen Mattson, Christina Russo, and Doug Schuchertz. Help this week from Addie Goss and Maura Kelly. Our senior producer is Tara Murphy. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.